As we are solely supported by listeners like yourselves. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up. It is almost 7 p.m. Stay tuned. WBAI New York.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, stay on the line and a hacker will assist you shortly.
It's time for Off the Hook. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, I'm over here.
Over there, and over in Skype land, I believe we have Alex. Alex, are you with us?
I am indeed. Good evening.
Coming to us live from the boondocks of Pennsylvania, I believe.
That is correct.
All right. Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead. You muted yourself somehow, Alex.
Oh, my goodness. You know, 2 years into this, you think I'd have this down? But I don't. You know, we're just not that great with technology. Pocono Mountains.
Pocono Mountains, yes. Any news of interest this week? Obviously, the war continues to be our top story and something that we're going to be focusing on tonight. I should also point out we're not on next week. So this is the last show for 2 weeks, and we'll be doing overtime at 8 o'clock on our YouTube channel, Channel 2600. So you can join us there. You can phone us up and ask questions and say various things. I do want to stress that listener mail is very important, and we want to hear your feedback, things that you have to say, positive or negative. You know, we've got a fair mix of both.
Yeah, it's always important to get a reaction, get feedback. We always love to get people's insights, hear what kinds of information they've been reading and taking in.
Yeah, yeah. We got an interesting piece of mail today. I believe this is from Finland, one of our listeners in Finland. I have emailed you in the past. I hugely appreciate both your shows, Off the Hook and Off the Wall, which we do on Tuesday nights on a different radio station. They are a unique voice, even by global standards. You are a good bunch of people. Thank you. That's just nice to hear that occasionally.
Yeah, people don't say that enough.
Well, you don't have to say it, but it's nice when it's said unprovoked. You know, a good bunch of people. Alex, I think that includes you.
I mean, maybe, sometimes. I mean, generally people disagree with me when they're writing in or calling in or whatever.
You can still be a good bunch of person, though, and disagree with.
Oh, I agree with that.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was the other way around, that he generally disagrees with everyone, but...
Well, he's disagreeable. There's no question.
When he says it like that, mm-hmm. it makes so much more sense.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about him later.
Yeah, we will.
Okay, so continuing with the letter. I live in Finland, which shares a huge border with Russia. And as you are probably well aware, we've had our dealings with them during World War II and at other points as well. This has been a stressful time these past several weeks as a fellow non-NATO Russian neighbor was invaded. And this is something maybe a lot of people don't know, is that Finland is not a NATO country. Neither is Sweden. And they're very close to Russia. They are friends with NATO. They do things with NATO, you know, have picnics and things. I don't know. But they're not a NATO member. So it's very similar. It's a very similar type of a situation as, you know, what Ukraine, minus the history, has currently. And it's definitely a stressful time over there.
They have shared interests.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Anyway, continuing with the letter, my optimism has grown with every day the war continues because Ukraine is fighting so bravely, and this is not the blitzkrieg that Putin hoped for. My God, today I just heard from NATO sources that the amount of Russian troops that have died could be 15,000. And when you consider that number, that horrendous number, you know, wasted lives, this did not have to happen. But what happened to our troops when we sent them to invade countries, Iraq and Afghanistan, horrible as that was, it took about 10 years, more than 10 years, I think, to get numbers like that on our side. Obviously, the numbers on the other side were infinitely huge. But in a few weeks, 15,000. If that is true, that is a staggering, staggering loss for Russia. And one that I assume Putin will be paying for the rest of his life, however long that may be. I feel like there is a good chance that this will become so expensive for Putin that he will need to give up or be taken out. And like you have said, there is no reason for animosity against the majority of Russian people. This is Putin's war. Amen on that. Absolutely. One thing I have noticed during this is that even though my brain knows that logically there is a long way from the current situation to a war against Finland, I do have a subconscious chest-tightening anxiety going on. I think we all can share that. Obviously, people who are near the border, more so. Thank you for your shows, and everyone, please keep donating as much as you can to Ukraine. That is probably the best the average person can do right now. Signed, Lob. Lob, thank you so much for this beautiful letter. Made our day. And thanks to everybody else who has written in with similar thoughts, and even the people that write in with non-similar thoughts. We want to hear all different sides. But, you know, one thing we don't want to hear is stupidity, you know. and when people say things like, we work for the government now because we're saying the same thing, or, you know, we're just basically following orders, it really, really is annoying, and it just it shows that you don't have much thought processing capability to think that because we say that Russia invading Ukraine is bad, and the U.S. government at the moment happens to say the same thing, that somehow we're working for the U.S. government. That is crazy. That is insane. Or that we are ignoring other injustices perpetrated by the U.S. or by NATO. We don't ignore that. If you listen to our history, you will find that out pretty quickly. But you have to call something out when it is happening right before your eyes. And it's just happening before all of our eyes. You can go to so many different sources. You can watch BBC World News. You can watch Euronews. You can watch CNN International. You can watch Deutsche Welle. You can watch France 24. You can watch Al Jazeera English. You can read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian, and just so many publications and outlets that are basically showing, sometimes live, what is happening right now. We have a camera up at this very moment, and we're watching the streets of Kyiv. And it's possible the air raid siren might go off again. It's possible there might be a missile strike. This is all unfolding in front of us. It's not some massive conspiracy to cover something up and attack Putin. There are a lot of people out there that really buy into the Russia Today propaganda, which we have called out. And when we call something out, it's not just because of who they are, it's because of what they say, and it's because of what the facts actually are. And that's something that I think we all need to simply look at and measure and compare and discuss. But you don't just throw out accusations and say, well, because you say this, that means you're that. No, that's not how it works. If you have to adjust your argument based on who you might agree with, then you don't have an argument. You just have a platform, and you're not actually thinking through the facts. Look at what's happening. Look at what's happening right in front of you, and focus on that.
As far as the government goes, we're aware getting it right from the U.S. government and national and international diplomacy standpoint, getting it right checks a lot of boxes. There's a lot of aspects of this that could be very beneficial getting it right. So we're aware of that overlap. But misplaced blame, conspiracies, false equivalencies, I'm sorry, I've been inoculated to it. We've been trading this. We've been hearing this stuff for, up almost half a dozen years, longer and longer if you really want to get into post-Soviet and Cold War politics. So these tactics and that kind of stuff, just don't write us. We don't need that guy. I mean, we'll look at it, but we're not going to take it to heart.
I think it's always good to write, because maybe when you write something out, you'll realize, hey, that doesn't make any sense. Or, I don't know, maybe you'll just feel better. Or, maybe you'll make us feel better as far as, doubling down on what we believe in and what we say is right and true and all that. And why we think you're a dumbass for accusing us of these things. It was the same thing with COVID, when we were basically saying, yeah, get the damn vaccine. It's effective. It's science. And all these people were saying that, we're basically working with the medical industry now, or, we're just being brainwashed, ignoring the facts, ignoring the science, ignoring what is right in front of them. You can't convince people who are brainwashed, and they would say the same thing of us. But I like to think we have science, we have facts, we have what's actually going on in front of our eyes on our side.
Yeah, we'll ingest it. We probably won't air it. And it's, it's basically a window into what's out there, into the things that people are trading in.
We'll air it, but we won't air it through your particular filters, because those filters are basically turning gravity upside down and saying the Earth is flat and whatever else. And just because someone has a different opinion does not mean that opinion gets equal airtime.
Well, it better be especially creative.
But, we should be challenged. Why do you believe what you believe? And I'm all for that. And in the hacker world, that's what we do. We challenge each other. And we consider alternatives. But to simply blindly buy into something based on no facts whatsoever, basically based on because you want to disagree with somebody, no, that's not the kind of thing that that we do. And sometimes it makes us shudder to realize who we happen to be agreeing with at the moment. Sometimes it's a lot easier than that. This is one of those times where it's easy.
Yeah, Alex, you know a lot about that.
Yeah, I always do. About agreeing, disagreeing, being disagreeable. But speaking of which, I feel like, we got to get the show back on the rails here.
We went off the rails? You think we went off the rails?
Wow. Sometimes we do. Somebody's got to reel us back in, and usually that's me, unfortunately.
Always the fishing analogies.
When we don't have Rob here, somebody's got to do the dirty work, I guess. So, but a couple of things to mention, I think, over the last week, one of which being both Microsoft and Okta seem to have been compromised by a quote-unquote hacker group coming out of, I believe, Brazil.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's bad, isn't it?
Well, it's really interesting when you think about, somebody who, is both a lawyer and a CISO and a security practitioner, the billions and billions of dollars that we spend on cybersecurity and all of these new systems and security controls, and then two of the world's biggest companies, one of which focuses entirely on secure authentication, Okta, get popped by a couple of teenagers out of Brazil. And as I understand it, I'm not sure the accuracy of this, but it seems like one of these young persons may have actually been located in Oxford, England. One of the ringleaders of the Lapsus group might have been located in Oxford, England. And as an Oxonian, I can take particular pride in the source of many of these hacks. But it's a very interesting commentary on the state of our security controls and how they can be manipulated. As I also understand the Okta breach, what the threat actors, I don't know if we can call them threat actors or if we can legitimately call them hackers in this situation, I'm not sure. I think we need to know a little bit more about the intentions behind the individuals who are responsible for this particular breach. But it does seem like they went after the credentials of a support engineer over at Okta, and I think it's come out today that that support engineer could have altered or modified in some way or reset, let's say, the multi-factor authentication mechanisms for over 360 organizations. So that's significant. That's a massive breach. And there are a lot of very large organizations that rely on Okta, and Okta has come to be known as, I think, one of the best in the business when it comes to secure authentication. And, you know, I leave it to you guys to talk about, you know, what does this mean for the state of those companies and the state of the state of their cybersecurity posture?
Well, I think this makes them look rather foolish. You know, it's we see the same thing virtually week after week, and this is it's not really that surprising.
Well, I disagree, not surprisingly, and I think that this is a commentary on the fact that it is such a hard job. There's such a wide latitude of things that we need to secure, of controls that need to be implemented, and it's such a complicated congeree of systems right now that there's going to be a vulnerability somewhere. And I think this underscores the need for organizations to not have the finger pointed at them and not be blamed for a lot of these breaches unless there's gross negligence or even, you know, actual negligence. I think gross negligence certainly, but you know, if there was some kind of duty and they failed to shoulder that particular duty with respect to an ordinary security control, I think that you know, we can lay some blame there, but that these things are going to happen and that organizations need to assume that breaches have happened and will happen, and fighting within the network, taking the fight from trying to just be reactive at the firewall level to what's happening within the network, you know, this quote unquote zero trust idea that we hear about constantly, mostly in you know, FUD type information security marketing, actually really means something here, that the segmentations of your networks and using VLANs to logically segment different portions of what is and what is not meaningful within your network, you know, so that if there is a threat actor or there is a breach, it is lateral movement is prohibited to a certain extent. You know, these are all things that I think, you know, we have to really start to think about much more seriously, given, you know, the Okta and the Microsoft breach. If it can happen to them, it can happen to anybody.
What do you think about this concept of them using their own platform? I guess Azure is the cloud-based product that Microsoft develops, and this development system that was breached had resided on one of Microsoft's products. Do you think that's smart? I don't think it is. I think maybe if you're running a product for sale that people are, you know, going to abuse, they're going to have access to various levels of programmatic stuff. I don't know. I don't know how it works. I've never bought a cloud system somewhere. But whatever it is, I think that, like, there's something to that, like, it being a widely used product, that it could be evaluated, and if you're using it for internal development, using the very system that you sell, it seems like you're opening up a way for people to exploit something. You maybe want to use something a little bit different or, like, kind of exotic or just weird internally to make it less obvious and less laterally available. Does that make sense?
I see your point. I think it's a fair point, Kyle. As sure. On the other hand, too, if you're not using your own systems, you know, that may say something about the company and the state of the system itself.
But I think there's been an overemphasis on that. Like, Google kind of runs their own OS and then develops everything on it, and there's been maybe it's maybe gone too far one way or something.
Well, yeah, I think we can agree that this underscores the need for there to be some kind of independent third-party assessment of the source code, of the vulnerabilities. You know, there's got to be some kind of mannerism or mechanism by which these companies that create this software are not essentially grading their own homework when it comes to assessing the security posture of these products. So, yeah, I completely agree. But even that's, you know, arguably not enough. Right, you know, something is going to shake out in one way or another. Now, we saw this with the Log4j vulnerability in that very well-known and well-used Java library that was really ubiquitous throughout the internet. That, you know, eventually something will shake out. It's a matter of how you detect it, when you detect it, and the process by which you remediate it. I think that makes all the difference here.
Interesting. I don't know if you've caught this story over the past couple of days, but there's a new public database that is being worked upon, and that involves an organization known as the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. They've collaborated with 27 media outlets to launch this tracker, the most comprehensive public database of oligarch assets to date. It's interactive. It displays the vast wealth held outside Russia by oligarchs and key figures close to Putin. It's uncovered more than 150 assets worth about $17 billion combined, including property, private planes, company stock, yachts, mansions, and more. And journalists are basically discovering these assets by combing through land records, corporate registries, and offshore leaks. The OCCRP, Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, their publisher, Drew Sullivan, said in a press release that Russia under Vladimir Putin has been controlled by a very small group of people, enablers who keep him in power while benefiting from his patronage system at the expense of the Russian people. That system has been under fresh scrutiny since Putin's invasion of Ukraine, as Western governments have sought to freeze Putin and the oligarchs' overseas assets and prevent them from traveling. Sanctions act as both a punishment for Russia's ruling class and a way to force Putin to back down. The idea was first conceived of back in February before Russia's invasion of Ukraine actually happened. That's according to The Guardian, which is part of the project. It launched with a list of 35 individuals named last year by the jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny as key enablers and beneficiaries of the Kremlin's kleptocracy. Just 3 weeks after the invasion, 27 of those individuals are subject to sanctions in the U.S. and Europe. A further 7 have been blacklisted in Canada. One of the people on that list of 35 is Roman Abramovich, a 55-year-old worth an estimated $13.5 billion. And although he has not been sanctioned by the U.K. and has denied ties to Putin, he recently announced he's selling his Chelsea football club, which he acquired in 2003. I believe that sale, though, has been put on hold. OCCRP's database shows he has at least $7 billion worth of assets. And that includes a seaside estate in the posh French Riviera, a Bombardier private jet, and several properties scattered throughout London. Others included in the database are businessmen Alisher Usmanov, Igor Seshin, the CEO of Russian oil giant Rosneft, and Oleg Deripaska, a billionaire who made his fortune in the aluminum business. The OCCRP has released other revealing exposés in the past, including a damning report about Credit Suisse that detailed clients that included criminals, alleged human rights abusers, and parties facing sanctions, and the Swiss bank pushed back on that report. Joining us tonight is the head of research at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, Karina Shedrovsky. She leads a team of researchers in 8 countries who man OCCRP ID, which helps journalists in the network track down people, companies, and assets across the globe. Karina, welcome to Off the Hook.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us how this project got started? Was it something that was completely inspired by Russia's actions, or has this been going on for some time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've kind of always been in the business of untangling these complicated structures of assets all over the world. And, you know, as Russia was readying to invade Ukraine, and then obviously after it happened, we saw a lot of news stories coming out about, you know, the oligarchs' assets all over the world, but in bits and pieces. And because this is kind of something we've always been doing, we thought it'd be really good to kind of have all of this collected in one place where we can kind of put a number to it and show just how vast their wealth actually is. So we worked super, super hard to kind of, you know, pull this together. And, you know, what we kind of decided to do to make it, you know, to show that it's a little bit different from everyone else's is that these are all assets that we, you know, have confirmed, like, through records, essentially. So a lot of the times you'll see articles about different planes and companies and such that were owned by these oligarchs. But, you know, a lot of it is kind of word of mouth and rumor, et cetera. So everything, you know, we decided to make this a database that's kind of the place to go for assets that are 100% confirmed by us and, you know, keep it living.
Is there an address that you can give out that people can look at this?
Well, so if you go to OCCRP.org, it's, you know, right at the top of our website, and you'll be able to see the interactive that, you know, where it is now. Like I said, we're going to continue adding to it, as well as some of the stories that we have published so far and that we'll continue to publish that go along with this specific interactive.
One of the things that I've heard consistently is that these oligarchs love to hide behind LLCs and that they're almost impossible to track down through that. Is that something that you folks have figured out a way to defeat?
I wish I could say yes completely. That's, you know, always part of the problem. And I think that that's kind of why this project was so important and so challenging, was because even if we do get the records, right, like someone says that Abramovich owns a property somewhere, and then you go to the property registry that may be open and you can see that the property is owned by a company, whether it's an LLC in the U.S. or another company somewhere else, and his name isn't anywhere. So that's kind of been the challenge. And there are a few ways that, you know, we've been able to kind of pierce through that a bit. And I think the biggest way has been through major leaks. So the Panama Papers and Paradise Papers, organized by ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, has been super helpful for us as we were kind of, you know, embarking on this big project.
That's so great to hear. Their work is benefiting in this investigation. And I just in my mind was thinking of the tactics of, like, patent trolls, because the same idea, basically, companies that are layers and layers of LLCs that all link back. And I think a lot of how that is coordinated or correlated is with addresses and lawyers and, you know, multiple companies being at the same lawyer's address. I think of those kinds of things when I've been reading about some of this stuff. And I realized, oh, is it the trolls themselves, the patent trolls that are borrowing these tactics from, like, organized crime or oligarchs and these strategies, or vice versa? And I think it's that the patent, the IP community borrowed these tactics, and because it seems like it's been ongoing and just worked so well that other areas of interest have adopted those techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, that's kind of what we focus on a lot, is who's actually enabling this and allowing this to happen. And it's really the legal systems that are in place that are, you know, helping people basically move their money out of the country or hide their wealth, avoid taxes, launder, you know, ill-gotten gains, whatever it may be. And they're using legitimate lawyers, registration agents, trusts, et cetera, that, you know, exist completely legally and are knowingly and willingly helping oftentimes bad actors hide.
Now, this has not been lost on the Russian government. I'm reading here a story from a few weeks ago saying that the Ministry of Justice has declared that your organization, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, has been designated an undesirable organization, and you must close up operations in their country. That must have really hurt your feelings to find out about that.
Yeah, some people like to think of it as a badge of honor. But, you know, I mean, if you can't have journalists on the ground in certain places, it obviously makes it a lot more difficult to do work. So it's, you know, and it even makes it illegal to reshare our stories in the country. So, you know, we're trying to reach as many people as possible. And, you know, for this specific story, I think audience in Russia is a major audience that, you know, should hear about this. So, you know, they're obviously making that a lot more difficult.
Not only an audience, but sources in Russia. There must be so many people there that can help with information.
You know, and like, but with this, that is true in general. And with this project, I think what's really interesting is that, and as you can see, if you actually look at the database, is that it just touches the entire globe. So there's actually, you know, sources and such all over the place. That, you know, have helped us in the past, and we're hoping continue to help us as we continue to build this database.
Go ahead, Alex.
Karina, we're so excited to have you on tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm sure our listeners are really enjoying this as well. What are some of the patterns that you've seen here in terms of geographies or items, you know? It's such a fascinating and bizarre world these Russian oligarchs have, you know, where they are essentially siphoning money from the government, somehow funneling it over into these foreign jurisdictions, and then leading these absolutely luxurious lives that have no relation whatsoever, no bearing whatsoever to ordinary Russians on the ground, you know, that are eking out a living. So, you know, where do you see these assets clustered? You know, are they in France? Are they in Italy? Is there any pattern?
Yeah. I think there's a pattern in terms of, you know, the luxurious places. We found a lot of, you know, really nice villas in Italy. There's, you know, villas and such in Croatia. And it's kind of just, you know, where can you get the biggest mansion? That's, you know, where we've been seeing most of the properties. And, you know, as we're starting to uncover these assets, you know, a lot of these assets that we included in the database are things that have already been known around the world. Other journalists have uncovered and such. But there's also a lot of new assets that we uncovered as well. And, you know, the world is huge. We decided to focus on these 35 people to start. And the idea is, you know, where do we look and where do we try to uncover these assets? And there are a few countries, jurisdictions that we decided to focus on that we thought would be, you know, they were more likely to own property or, you know, companies. But in addition to that, the companies and properties are airplanes, private jets, and mega yachts. And those, you know, there's only a handful of jurisdictions that they actually register those. The Isle of Man was huge, Luxembourg, Cayman Islands, et cetera. So those were kind of places that we decided to start focusing on. And then you can see patterns in terms of where people are starting to actually move their money after the sanctions started. So you actually can watch the yachts and airplanes start flying to Dubai or back to Russia and, you know, starting to move out of Europe and places where they've been sanctioned to try to hang on to their assets or as many of them as they can.
I'm going to monopolize you here for a minute. You know, we're live on the air in New York City. And so what about New York? Can you recall any assets in New York?
Yeah, I mean, there are tons. There are – so we actually decided to – we had 3 weeks to put this out. We had to limit ourselves a lot, which is why this is kind of a project that we've decided is going to, you know, just live on. And we're going to keep adding to it. So we decided to, you know, not focus on the U.S. in our first round. But there are tons of assets in New York specifically. And like you had mentioned before, they are owned by LLCs that are registered in Delaware, for example. So I can't think of addresses off the top of my head, but the answer is yes. And, you know, we basically, a lot of them still we don't really know about, right, because we just can't absolutely prove it with 100% certainty that the true owner is, you know, the specific oligarch that we're looking into. But, you know, based on past reporting and such, and some of our current reporting that has not been released yet, there are other assets in New York and the rest of the U.S. that we are definitely going to include, you know, going forward.
Yeah, and with that in mind, you know, if you think about what sanctions are, in essence, all it is a list. It's just a list. Your name is on a list somewhere. If you're sanctioned, you're a sanctioned organization, you're a sanctioned individual, your name is put on a list, and it's the naughty list. It's kind of like, you know, Santa's don't you know, coal list at Christmas, right? So if your name is on this list, in reality, all you have to do to get around sanctions is to form some kind of LLC, maybe with some kind of BVI overlay that's then owned by a trust. And you know, the people that are examining these lists, you know, whether they're yacht dealers or luxury jewelers, whatever it is, seem to have an incentive not to really dig too far. So
really,
to your mind and you know, based on what you've seen with respect to these Russian oligarchs and others, I know you've been involved in so many interesting journalistic projects that involve asset tracking. Do you think that sanctions are effective? Because this is something that we keep banging on about from the pedestals of the White House about, you know, we're doing this in lieu of military force, in lieu of sending people over in Ukraine to put boots on the ground. We have sanctions. Do you think they're effective?
I think they're effective as long as you can identify all of those assets. And I think that's kind of what we're attempting to do, right? We're trying to say, okay, we actually know that this LLC that owns this property in New York belongs to this guy. So, hello, government, you know, this is something that should also be seized or, you know, sanctioned or taken away from him. So I think that they, in theory, will work. But as long as people are, you know, hiding their wealth, it becomes a lot more difficult. And I know that the authorities are having just as much trouble as we are actually confirming the ownership of a lot of these assets. So, you know, there's yachts that are rumored to be owned by Usmanov, and I know that was seized. And it took a really long time to actually follow the ownership chain up and say, okay, this is 100% his yacht. So, you know, it's only as effective as long as you know their assets. And also, I think that it's, you know, it goes to the last country that's willing to take their money. So if the UAE is willing to take all of their money and doesn't really care, and they can just move all of their money into the UAE, fly all of their jets there and sell all of their yachts there, then it doesn't really matter that they're sanctioned elsewhere if they can kind of, you know, keep doing business just somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm really hopeful that the overall climate, specifically here in the U.S., as far as attitudes around this, given the circumstance, given the severity and the nature of these particular sanctions and why they're being imposed, I hope that there is a little bit more help and willingness, I think, to get some of the answers that are needed to trace some of that stuff. And in response to the just general idea of sanctions and their effectiveness, I think I'm very much, I hear where Alex has gone with that. I'm just hopeful, and I think a lot of people are, that this is a lag period between when sanctions are imposed and they've been successively increased and broadened in breadth. But their impact and actual effects are sort of a rolling thing in my mind that will just be ongoing and continue. And the benefit of this tactic is that it is all entirely reversible in many ways, reputations aside. But that this is something that really hasn't fully reached a crescendo of impact. Is that the way anyone else has thought of this?
Yeah, I think so for sure, and I think that leads into another question here too for Carino that I had in particular, which was that, you know, you mentioned this the seizure component of this, and I think, you know, in the United States and elsewhere, it might be difficult, or the authorities may be reluctant to seize certain property unless it's used in the commission of a crime, or is derived from the proceeds of a crime. And you know, we've got that pesky Fifth Amendment that says, you know, nobody can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So that can be a little tricky. So we have this concept of due process. You know, before we take something, we have to provide the owner of that property some form of process, and due process generally means an opportunity to be heard by an impartial tribunal most of the time. So, you know, are you seeing it difficult or getting pushback from governments once you identify these assets, and is it frustrating to see that they're not being seized? But then on the other hand, too, I've noted that, you know, over the last few days at least, governments like Switzerland have been actually seizing assets. So there may be this opportunity for your organization to work with governments and facilitate the seizure of these Russian assets.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's a big part of why we're doing this, you know, not to help governments specifically, but to kind of just expose these things in general. And, you know, some of the assets that we have been exposing are new, that, you know, haven't been seized yet, haven't been reported on. And the idea is, like I said earlier, to say, hey, look, you know, this property still exists. And we have been seeing governments, you know, seizing assets as well as deregistering planes. So the Isle of Man last week deregistered, I think it was 18 planes that were Russian owned. That, you know, for the longest time we had been tracking these planes because we thought they were connected to certain individuals. And then, you know, it kind of was confirmed to us when the Isle of Man actually just deregistered them, meaning that, you know, they're currently not registered anywhere and therefore can't fly, et cetera. So I actually do see, you know, a lot of governments actually acting. And I think that that's something, you know, as Kyle mentioned about awareness now increasing. And I think that, you know, I don't want to say silver lining because there's no silver lining mm-hmm. to what's happening in Ukraine right now. But, you know, we have been in the business of exposing this stuff for years and saying that, you know, the fact that these murky institutions exist and the fact that you can hide money abroad is bad, right, and should change. And, you know, we've had a kind of niche audience and people, you know, and now all of a sudden I think people are starting to realize, wow, these systems actually are really bad. And hopefully this is the opportunity to actually do something about it. Because, you know, none of this is new. People are just starting to pay attention to it. And, you know, it's not something like they didn't just buy the houses yesterday. They've been hiding these assets deeper and deeper for years. And it's the systems and the laws that are in place in these countries that have been allowing it. And, you know, making their jobs more difficult now that they're trying to actually do something and seize the assets. And I'm sure they're thinking to themselves, like, wow, I wish I didn't make it so easy for them to, you know, buy this property without me knowing who they are. So hopefully, you know, as this awareness, you know, continues to spread and increase, governments, you know, kind of continue on with this momentum and start, you know, changing the actual systems in place that have been allowing them to do this for as long as they have.
It must be not so much of a challenge to find a super yacht in the area, because super yachts seem to be the thing that all these oligarchs have, in addition to private planes and mansions. Is there a database of super yachts somewhere? I mean, I don't know anybody with a super yacht, but if I saw one nearby, I'd want to know who owns that. And I figure word must go out saying there's a super yacht in the area, it belongs to this particular person, or we don't know who it belongs to. Is it possible that through crowdsourcing we could just sort of keep track of all these things that are just floating around?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's something that we've actually been doing for ages was we have, you know, we've been tracking planes and yachts. And this is based off of crowdsourcing, right? Like my number one source has been Twitter. There's tons of hobbyists who basically look at airplanes and take pictures of them. And same thing with yachts. And then sometimes someone actually spotted someone on that yacht. And now kind of the public has and, you know, knows that some or has an idea that this yacht or plane belongs to this person. But, you know, and this is something that we've always been tracking and keeping track of. But the problem is that we couldn't actually include all of them on our actual database because we still couldn't actually confirm the ownership 100%. So we actually had put out a call for help. You know, we had kind of our top 10 most wanted assets where they were assets that we just know and so many people know or think we know belong to certain individuals. but we just, like, did not have the evidence to absolutely 100% prove it. So we actually, you know, part of this project was a call to the public to basically help us crowdsource this project. And, you know, we'll then be able to follow those leads and hopefully confirm a lot of them. But, you know, it's kind of just, that's exactly it, just crowdsource information. And the official registry is where people actually register their boats and planes are not very helpful at all.
For people tuning in, we're talking with Karina Shadrowski, head of research at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and specifically talking about tracking Russian assets. And Karina, as I understand it, you have some particular expertise in plane tracking. We'd love to hear more about that and how you got into it and how you do it.
Yeah, it kind of just happened upon me. But, you know, part of the plane tracking is twofold. One is to obviously connect it to certain individuals that we're interested in. And then the second is actually tracking their locations, right, and where they actually are. And like I said, most of the planes that we had kind of been tracking in the past were based on crowdsourcing, based on Twitter, based on blogs, and very few we are able to absolutely, with 100% certainty, connect to the people that we thought they were connected to, but we were still tracking them anyway. And what we actually found was that, you know, tracking their actual location helped us in connecting them to the specific people that we thought were on them. So if we know that somebody has been, you know, around in 12 different locations, and we could see that their plane was in those exact same 12 locations, we are pretty certain that that's a plane that they at least that they either own or they at least use. So there's a number of tools that we actually use to track the planes. One thing I want to mention is that, you know, anyone could do this. There's websites online that if you know some identifying information about the plane, you can actually, you know, go to something called Flight Radar and track where it is. If you don't pay for it, you can just see, you know, live tracking. But these websites, actually, you can request to have your plane's data redacted. So we're now relying on a lot of kind of, again, open source, uncensored ADS-B, it's called, data, where we can actually track the planes that are trying to remain hidden, but we can actually still see where they're going. So that's been helpful in, one, identifying their assets as, you know, the jets themselves, but also as in kind of confirming whether or not they're still using the villas that we, you know, we're pretty sure that they owned as well. For example, we were looking at Igor Shublov, one of the oligarchs that we covered in this database, and we had evidence that he owned a villa in Tuscany. And we kind of, this was in one of the new assets that we had uncovered, and we basically were able to use company records and the land registry to actually find this villa. But the problem was is that it was ultimately owned by a BVI company, or until 2017. And we knew that that BVI company was connected to him, but and we knew he owned it because thanks to the Panama Paradise Papers. But then it stopped owning that, you know, the property. The BVI company kind of went away. But what we saw when we actually tracked his jet was that it was still landing right by that villa. So we're kind of able to track the movements and confirm our suspicions or, you know, basically help our reporting to add, like, another level of confirmation that, you know, whether it's the asset itself as the jet or other assets that they're actually flying their planes or helicopters to.
And do you have any sense of what influence family members, like transference of some of this stuff to people related to someone on a sanctioned individuals list? What does that look like, or how have you navigated some of those layers or removed individuals?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, you know, even that example that I just gave you with Shuvalov and the villa, that BVI company was actually owned by his son, who was 24 at the time, I think, when we kind of discovered the ownership. So, you know, we are actually looking into the close family members and the known, you know, proxies while we're trying to track the assets of, you know, the people of interest. Because, yes, we've seen a lot that they're, you know, just transferring the assets to people very close to them.
Well, I'm just so impressed with how you're activated in this moment, and your work is so needed and welcome. And people love a puzzle, and like doing a top 10 that you want help with, that is so great because it really gets people excited about figuring out, trying to solve a problem and bringing everything they can think of to it.
Karina Shevdrovsky is the head of research at Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and you can go to their website, OCCRP.org. Karina, if people want to help, what can they do?
Yeah, well, two things, I guess. So one, we are, like I said, we are crowdsourcing this. So if you go to the project page, we have, it's literally a Google form. So if you have a lead and you think that someone might own an asset that we don't know about yet, please submit it. We're going through all of them. We've already had some really helpful tips, which is actually really exciting. So just for this specific project, that would be a huge help. And we're looking for, all of that information. Another thing I guess I want to mention is we have a webinar coming up on April 1st where journalists that were working on this project journalists from The Guardian and OCCRP are talking about, how we did it and what we did. And the way that you can attend is if you become what we call an OCCRP accomplice. So if you donate however much money you want, you can then become an OCCRP accomplice and come to this webinar and future webinars that we do on big projects that we release.
Awesome. Karina, your work is amazing, and your organization is amazing, and it's really making a difference. I'm not sure what kind of feedback you've gotten from people in Ukraine, but I'm sure everyone there would be most appreciative of these efforts, and maybe people all around the world will see the value of this.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right. That's going to do it for the show tonight. We will be back in 2 weeks for another edition of Off the Hook, and we're coming on overtime on YouTube on Channel 2600 in just about 9 minutes at 8 o'clock. Alex, I know you have something to say.
Yeah, I learned last night that we have an interesting contingent of listeners that are wandering around Dead Horse Bay in Brooklyn. Just want to give them a quick shout-out.
What is Dead Horse Bay?
Well, that's something that you'll have to look up. We can talk about that on overtime. It's a very unique place in Brooklyn where, much like what Karina does, there is treasure to be hunted.
Well, there always is. That's something in the hacker world that we know a bit about. More stuff is happening with Hope coming up July 22nd through 24th in New York City at St. John's University in Queens. Go to hope.net for more details. We're looking for more speaker submissions, volunteers, you name it. It's going to be an amazing conference. 2600 meetings coming up first Friday of the month in cities throughout the world. Go to 2600.com/meetings for more information on that. We're going to go out with a classic tune with some new lyrics that might pertain to what's going on in the world. See you at overtime at 8 o'clock and on the air in 2 weeks. Good night.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York.